Now, as I understand it, The Man Within My Head, the title of your book, is a reference to the writer Graham Greene, whom many people will know as the author of The Quiet American. Was this a surprise to you to discover him there?
No, I think I wrote the book to try to explore why he was there, what he was doing there, uninvited, and why he was there prominent more than many of the other writers whom I love and who in some ways are almost closer to my heart.
I was surprised, I have to confess, when I discovered that it was Graham Greene you were writing about. I had read the first page or page and a half and assumed without thinking about it and without having looked at the advance information that you were writing about your father. Were you?
No, and it was only when I began to think about Graham Greene and I began to think about why we create these shadow fathers or these alternative parents in our heads, almost in response to the parents who created us, that I began to think more about my real father and think why did I need to create Graham Greene or my projected image of Graham Greene as a way to escape from home in some ways. If you'd asked me 5 years ago, who's the man within your head, I would have said Henry David Thoreau or Ralph Waldo Emerson or one of the great writers who's inspired me for so long. But what I found the more I traveled around the world is that again and again, I would be stumbling into a Graham Greene novel, almost as if I were just a figment of his imagination or as if he were scripting my future. And so I thought I should look more closely at Graham Greene. And the more closely I looked at Graham Greene, the more that opened up doors of questions about my father and even about aspects of myself.
So let's talk a little bit about Graham Greene. I'm afraid that some people won't know much about him other than perhaps The Quiet American. He does bear some resemblance to you, doesn't he? At least in his background.
He does. When my friends ask me, what's with this Graham Greene fascination, I will tell them that I grew up in middle-class England on a street in Oxford, very close to a street where he had lived. And then I went through classic English boarding schools, just the kind that he went through. And maybe because of those classic English boarding schools, I've never really settled down within a family or community, just as he didn't. And I've spent much of my life traveling to places like Saigon and Havana and Haiti and Paraguay, just as he did. And I've always been fascinated by, I suppose, the paradoxes and complexities of faith, just as he was. And yet, I could list all those reasons of things that we have in common, and yet I don't think there would begin to be an explanation, because I think the power of affinity lies in its mystery. It's like when you walk into a crowded room and you see a stranger, and somehow you feel as if you know her better than you know any of the friends that you came with. So I think at heart, it's something as inexplicable as why I feel at home in Japan more than in the house or the street where I was born.
Of course, the parallels between one life and another are easy to see. The disparities are not as easy. And so did you worry at all ever about finding only the things that were similar in your lives?
I didn't, because I so trust this sense of connection and I feel such a kinship with him that I think even the seeming discrepancies may reveal similarities that I hadn't seen or didn't want to consider. Graham Greene is most famous for being very English, for being very Catholic or having a vexed relationship with Catholicism, and for always presenting himself as a sinner. So for me to associate myself with Graham Greene is a treacherous thing to do, because he kept on stressing how many people he betrayed and how he never lived up to his ideals and how fallen he was. And yet what I always am moved by in him is his unsparing honesty and the fact that he presents himself as a sinner, so we have very low expectations of him and of his characters, and yet in book after book, even the most terrified and lost characters suddenly act much better than we imagine or even than they imagine. So in some ways, it's a very hopeful thing. And so even when I see the many things that I don't share with him, I feel that it's worth looking more closely at them. For example, he could hold many, many bottles of drink, and always drink played a large part in his life. I'm a teetotaler. But it doesn't matter. What he was doing when he was getting drunk was probably looking fearlessly at the difficult parts of himself and the difficult parts of the world. And I thought, well, that's something I would really aspire to do and maybe have begun to do already.
I'm a great admirer of the writing of Graham Greene, I have to say, but he is also somebody who makes me a little nervous. He was always running away, it seems to me. You point out at one point in The Man Within My Head that even in the matter of religion, he was a determined Catholic but called himself a Catholic agnostic, which suggests that he was even running away from his religion, wasn't he?
Perfectly said. He was running away from categories and definitions, any labels we could put on him. And you're absolutely right. His first memoir was called Ways of Escape. His stories are fascinated by the hunted man, the man always running away, usually into the shadows. And he always said that he traveled in order to escape boredom and to escape familiarity. And so again, by allying myself with him, I'm asking myself some rather unsettling questions. Why am I escaping? What am I trying to escape from? And I don't know that I can offer the answers. But I would say that I think, like most of us, I tend to try to look away from the more challenging or unsettled parts of myself just in order to function. And Graham Greene is always pushing me, maybe even as a renegade priest might, to look at those shadows and corners in myself that otherwise I would try to run away from or try to avert my attention from. And when he lives outside categories, he's an Englishman who only felt happy outside of England. As you said, he is somebody who became a Catholic to marry his wife when he was 24, but was always running from God. I can relate to some of that because I grew up as a child of Indian parents, born in England and then moving to California. I've never felt comfortable when somebody tries to push me into one box or another. And I wrote a long book on Islam and a long book on the Dalai Lama and now a long book on Catholicism. So I have a great interest in all these traditions, but if anyone were to try to straitjacket me within one, I would find a way to wriggle out. So I think in some ways I love his freedom from affiliation.
And in some ways, he is a kind of religion to himself, isn't he? There's a point in the book when you talk to him, and again, it's about his running away, I think. You refer to him as the patron saint of the foreigner alone, which covers an awful lot of ground.
It does. And I think he's really, in his books, was writing a gospel for humanity or a gospel for the fallen, and the gospel for the uncertain. And one thing that moves me in his books is that he always puts kindness before doctrine. In other words, what you do in the world is much more important than what you believe. And at a certain level, I think there's much to be said for that, because in our beliefs, we're likely to retreat into a kind of us or them position, or it's easy to fall into a very fixed doctrine or dogma. But in terms of just kindness and extending your hand to the person in need, I think that is nearly always an unequivocal good. And as I mentioned, my last book was on the Dalai Lama, and one of the things that moves me about him is that when he travels around the world, although he's the most visible Buddhist, he tells people not to take up Buddhism and to stay within their own traditions. And he recently brought out a book called Beyond Religion, in which he said, it doesn't matter if humanity or human beings have religion or not. The most important thing is to bring kindness and responsibility to the people around you. And in his very backwards way, I find Graham Greene coming to much the same position and really telling us that often an unwise man has as much to offer us as a wise man. And it's the fallen person that we can relate to who sometimes can inspire us just as much as a saint.
There's a story you tell that I think may add to what you were just saying. There's a story of something that occurred to you, a story, a dream perhaps, on Easter Island. You were talking about a priest who went there and went with very fixed ideas and then hoped the Vatican never discovered who and what he had become.
Yes, I took my mother, who luckily is a very adventurous traveller, to Easter Island for the first day of the millennium, in fact, for December 31st, 1999. And we went to a service in the church there, and it was an interesting service because the priest was wearing a white robe with Rongo Rongo symbols, and Jesus against the wall looked like one of the stone heads, the haunting Moai presences of Easter Island. And after we returned to our motel, I just walked out onto the green grass next to the black rocks against which the ocean is crashing, and you can feel the sense of emptiness there because there isn't another inhabited place for 1,300 miles, and the wind was whistling in my ears, and out of nowhere, I just sat down and wrote a story about the renegade priest. And it was only when I finished it that I thought, my goodness, anyone reading this would think that I had just stolen the idea from Graham Greene. He seeped into my imagination. I remember there was a time a few years ago when his centennial occurred in 2004, and his publishers decided to reissue all his books with introductions. And I was asked to write an introduction to his complete short stories. So I spent a few days reading his stories again. And then, much to my surprise, I started writing Graham Greene stories. And every morning I would go to my desk and I would imagine him in a place he'd never been, or I'd see him through the eyes of some fictional friend, or I would take his book Travels with My Aunt and have his aunt guide the fictional Greene to some place he'd never been. And suddenly it was as if I was just channeling him. And I don't know if the sketches I wrote in the mode of Greene were any good, but I thought, this is an interesting thing, that my imagination is leading me again and again back to this questioning figure.
It must be fascinating and a little bit frightening in a way to find someone occupying your consciousness so completely, although you seem to be able to keep him at enough of a distance so that you don't lose your own identity.
Well, I think sometimes I feared I was losing my own identity, and it is unsettling, especially when he's such a troubled figure. I mean, if it was the Dalai Lama or Bishop Tutu or Gandhi or Martin Luther King in my head, I'd be thrilled. But Graham Greene is a much more tangled prospect. But I remember once, for example, I was in a little hotel in southern Cuba called the Casa Grande. And I walked out of it and I got into a car to look around. And as soon as I did, a stranger slipped into the front seat and promised to show me around. And his name, disconcertingly, was Faust. And a few years later, after I'd got back home, I was reading a biography of Graham Greene, and I found that 35 years before me, he'd been in a little place called the Hotel Casa Grande. He'd stepped out of it. He'd got into a car to look around. A stranger had slipped into the car, promising to show him around. And I went on reading in that biography, and I found him at one point making confession before a priest called Father Pilkington, and remembering that for the four formative years of my growing up, the man responsible for my spiritual welfare, my housemaster in school, was a priest called Father Pilkington. And then I read on in the biography, and I found that in the 1970s, Graham Greene suddenly came up with this crazy idea of writing a play about a very obscure 19th century romantic painter called Benjamin Robert Hayden. And I recalled how, at the end of the 1970s, as a young kid in graduate school, I'd come up with this crazy idea of writing a doctoral dissertation on a very obscure 19th century romantic painter called Benjamin Robert Hayden. And it went on and on, and I think it became most unnerving when I read that Graham Greene had had a fear all his life of seeing his house burned down, which is a strange fear for somebody growing up in quiet suburban England. But during World War II, German bombs hit his house and it was reduced to ash. And I, in my 30s, was one day walking up the stairs in my parents' house in Santa Barbara, California, and I suddenly looked up and there were 70-foot flames encircling our house, and this Californian forest fire wiped out the house and everything in it. And then I really began to think, I wish my life wasn't having all these correspondences with Graham Greene. What kind of hex has he cast on me?
You know, it's fascinating to listen to you tell these stories, but it does make me want to ask a question that, frankly, I was going to ask you anyway. What is the line between fiction and nonfiction? I mean, there's no question that what you've written in The Man Within My Head is nonfiction, but you certainly bring a novelist's tools to it.
Well, thank you. I'll take that as a compliment. And I was beginning to wonder the same question. In other words, what are the lines between my real life and his imagination? And he was always fascinated by the workings of the subconscious. When he was 16 years old, he ran away from his boarding school, perhaps partly because his father was the headmaster. And although they caught him, his parents decided to let him spend 6 months when he was 16 in London living with a Jungian dream analyst. And I think those were very formative months for him. And for the rest of his life, he was fascinated in the alternative world of dreams. And he sensed that in writing, as in dreaming, we can tell the future as much as the past, that you'll write a story today or you'll wake up and record a dream today and 9 months from now it suddenly becomes true. Or that he will write a story for example, he wrote a short story in 1934 imagining a dead woman found in a British railway station. 4 months later, a real dead woman was found in a British railway station. He once dreamed of a ship going down in the Irish Sea, and 5 days later he found that that very night, while he was dreaming, a ship had gone down in the Irish Sea. And so this is a long, roundabout way of saying that there's a different kind of logic at work in the realm of the subconscious, which means that you almost lose track of what is fiction and what is non-fiction, and you realize that the imagination can intuit truths that perhaps our other senses can't, and that what we think is fiction actually turns out to be our real life. I remember I was once writing a book about a couple who were very similar to a couple in real life, and I ended my book with them separate, even though in real life they seemed very close. And the minute the book came out, that couple separated. And again, I thought, what have I loosed upon the world? What have I done with my imagination that may somehow have corresponded to some trauma in their real lives?
All of us, I think, have fears that the things we think of may come true from time to time and are glad when they don't. It sounds as though you must feel that even more strongly than most, and perhaps Graham Greene did as well.
I think so. He always had a keen sense of being haunted, and I don't think he ever realized how much he would haunt other people. And one thing that fascinates me is that if you look at his contemporaries, let's say George Orwell or Aldous Huxley or Evelyn Waugh, many of them are much more highly regarded these days as writers, and yet none of them had the gift of somehow stealing into people's souls and getting within their beings, either as a benign presence or as a terrifying one, the way Greene did. And while I was writing my book, I probably came across 7 or 8 other books written by radically different people, all about being possessed by Graham Greene. And sometimes they described it almost as a demonic possession, and sometimes they regarded it as an inspiration. And one interesting thing is that his mother was the first cousin of Robert Louis Stevenson, who, of course, gave the world the story of Jekyll and Hyde. And I think Greene never forgot that it was in his blood and in his DNA the legacy of Jekyll and Hyde. So these things were not just books on his shelf, but themes that he felt almost contending in his soul.
As you say, Greene's life was filled with things that make good stories, and they certainly made good stories for his biographers. But there's also a kind of reality to it that you can't avoid. The letters that he wrote, really over-the-top letters to his mistress, Catherine, I gather that you found those pretty hard to put down.
I did, because Graham Greene, like many middle-class Englishmen of his age and type, was very, very veiled in private. On the page, he's naked, and you almost sense somebody kneeling by the bed praying to a god he doesn't believe in while mortifier is breaking out all around. But in real life, he was guarded and private and elusive and never said very much about himself. And it was only in the late years of his life, and after his death, in fact, that his biographer published these torrential love letters that Greene had written in his 40s when he fell in love with an American woman. And I think they're some of the great love letters of our century. They're in volume 2 of the huge biography of Graham Greene by Norman Sherry. So when I read them, I was caught up in the passion and the drama of these two people and shaken as anybody would. But then, after reading them, I went back to volume 1 and I found that as a young man, Greene had written the same kind of letters to his wife 25 years earlier. He'd written her 2,000 letters in 2 years, I think, and at some points he would write her 3 love letters a day. And so first that made me think, well, was he really speaking his heart, or when he was seeming most passionate, was he just trying to persuade these young women to run away with him? Were the love letters in fact revealing the person who really was there behind the artist, or were they actually works of art? And even when he's sharing his heart with another person, he's a very conscious novelist. And then the next question after that was for myself, which is that if I relate so much to Graham Greene and I'm getting so excited about his love letters, what does that say about me when I have written love letters in the past? Am I interested in the writing or in the feeling of intoxication, or really in the other person? And I again, it's not a question I could answer, but I thought it was a very good question to ask myself.
It's also a moment at which you must be tempted to step back from Graham Greene just a little and say to yourself, perhaps I don't know him as well as I thought I did.
Yes, you're right. When I came upon those letters, I did think that, but I also thought, I'm thrilled, I'm vindicated, because this is a Graham Greene I've believed in all along. I always have felt he was a tender, generous, fervent, emotional person beneath the cover of an Englishman. So a part of me thought, yes, this is indeed the Graham Greene that I've counted on. But you're right, I am tempted to step back from him quite often when I see these similarities. But he had a great gift for intimacy on the page. And a lot of his books were about loneliness. And I think his vision of the world is of a man in a foreign town by himself, not really knowing how what's going on around him and how to conduct himself. And all he has to do is meet one other person. Often it's a person on the other side of the political divide or a seeming enemy. And these two lonely people become friends and offer a solace to one another that they can't even find in church or in their holy books. And so in that sense, I love the sense of being a friend of Graham Greene. And I feel his fears and his guilts and his terrors as I don't even feel or know those of people around me. And I'm happy to be brought into the conversation with him. And I think he can read me and I can read him, perhaps as it's difficult to do with many other people.
I have to confess that one of his novels that probably had the most resonance for me was The Quiet American. I am of the generation that thought so much about America's involvement in Vietnam. And even though this story takes place well before that, in the 1950s, it's deathless in a way. But it's also what you're talking about. It is a lonely Englishman, a jaded English hero of the book, and a brash American who become unlikely friends.
Yes, and I'm so glad you singled that out, because that book, too, is my kind of unofficial Bible. And in fact, I've been telling my friends, if they want to enjoy my book, maybe it's a good idea to read The Quiet American beforehand, because my book draws upon it so much. And just as you say, it's an example also of his ability to look into the future, because there he was in Saigon in 1953, and he's writing about napalm bombing and CIA intrigue and American agents trying to find Vietnamese proxies, and just as you said, he's writing about a young American who comes into Vietnam determined to remake the whole ancient culture in the light of America and all that he's just learnt in Harvard Yard. So in 1953, Greene was writing precisely and perfectly about what would happen in 1965. If you walk down the streets of Hanoi today, the book that all the people in the streets are trying to sell you is The Quiet American. When the book was shot as a movie recently, it was screened before its producers on September the 10th, 2001, and then had to be held back and delayed for more than a year because it so exactly foretold what was about to happen in Afghanistan and what was later to happen in Iraq. And as you say, it's deathless because to an uncanny degree, he gives us these very living, real human beings, but he also catches these almost eternal patterns that keep playing out. And in The Quiet American that he described 60 years ago, I think you can see what's going to happen in Afghanistan next year and probably in many places 10 years from now. And in that sense, he was a teller of the future.
Because The Quiet American is so important to you, or at least partly because of that, you have actually traced Graham Greene's steps there, haven't you? You went to Saigon, you went to Vietnam. Did you feel his presence? Did it seem as real as he had described?
Yes, so as ever, it was worse than that because I wasn't consciously retracing his steps. In fact, I was eager to trace my own steps, really, and make my own path through the world. So I just happened to go to Saigon a few years ago. It was a long flight from California. I got there at midnight, and I was full of excitement being out of the plane, and I was jet-lagged and full of adrenaline. So I started walking up and down the nighttime streets. And in 2004, the nighttime streets of Saigon seemed identical to the ones that he had described in 1953. So I went into an internet cafe and I began emailing a friend of mine whom I'd grown up with in Oxford 40 years before. And I said, you wouldn't believe it. I feel as if willy-nilly, without intending to, I've stepped into Greene's novel, The Quiet American. And I can just imagine his characters, Fowler and Fong, the jaded Englishman and the Vietnamese young woman, all around me. And as I was sitting in the internet cafe typing this, a young woman came in from the bar next door, and she sat next to me on a tall stool and began logging on. And I'm afraid, as a writer, I'm shameless. So as I was pretending to type my message, I was looking over to see what she was writing. And she was responding to a love letter from an admirer in Europe. And it began, Dear Fong, In other words, the woman in 2004, young, beautiful, ambiguous, who stepped into the internet cafe next to me had the same name and it seemed the same occupation. It was identical to the one that I'd read about in The Quiet American and that I was writing about at that moment to my friend. And Green, over and over, had that gift for seeming to script one's movements. If you walk through Haiti in the Hotel Olufsen today, you will feel that you're walking through Graham Greene's novel, The Comedians. If you go to Paraguay, it's almost impossible not to feel you're retracing his steps, even if you never wanted to.
And worse, perhaps, at the end of the book, you describe a trip that you and your friend Lewis took to Bolivia, which involved a terrible car accident. And as far as I know, Greene was never in Bolivia, but the way you tell the story suggests that that he was there for you.
There for me, yes, in so many ways. And I guess what this whole book is about is that initially I just noted the correspondences, the fact that we would have habits and places and names in common. But the more deeply I continued the investigation, the more I felt and found there was something much deeper having to do with the habits of our mind and the way our hearts worked and the way our souls trembled that was very similar. And finally I got to a place where I thought, really, I can't begin to explain this or put words to it, but there's a strong kinship. But indeed, in Bolivia, we had this terrible car crash. We were at 12,000 feet on New Year's Day again. There was nothing but blood and glass in the road. And suddenly, out of nowhere, my friend and the driver, both with blood pouring down their faces, a car came around the corner on New Year's Day. And a very well-dressed, prosperous-seeming man leapt out and said, "How can I help you?" And more amazingly, within a few minutes, although this was an area so underdeveloped they don't even speak Spanish, only the native language of Quechua, this gentleman began speaking English. And he said, "Don't worry, I'll take you to the nearest hospital. Get into my SUV and I'll take you there." So a good Samaritan, a kind of out of nowhere, a figure coming to rescue us in our moment of most intense need. And as we were driving to the nearest hospital, I asked him, "Are you a businessman? What are you doing in remote rural Bolivia? You seem like such a sophisticated man of the world." And he said, "Well, I'm the bishop of Potosi, and I'm going to deliver a mass for New Year's Day." And at that point, I remembered first that Graham Greene had written about a bishop of San Luis Potosi in a book about Mexico 70 years earlier. But more, just as you said, Graham Greene had somehow rescued us. Somehow, if you were to make a story about being on a remote road in Bolivia and the person who rescues you is a bishop, that would seem too good to be true, as it were. But there it was. And so I felt that Graham Greene had put us in very good hands.
Now, in the real world, you never actually met Graham Greene, did you? But you must feel as though you had.
And I was actually quite happy not to have met him, because I thought first that if I had met him, I would be distracted by his high voice or the colour of his face or all the physical mannerisms, and that in some ways I'd be interacting with a much less deep person than the one I met in his books. And I'm also conscious that writers are almost two selves. There's one who goes around the world, and there's another one who comes out only when you're alone at your desk. And so a writer is the most private of beings. And so to have a public interaction with a writer is usually to see only the least interesting and least remarkable side of him. So I never really wanted to meet him. Finally, at one point, I wrote a letter to him to ask if he wanted to sit down for an interview, because I knew he was not far from his last days. And he said no. And a part of me was relieved. And as the years have gone on, I'm so glad that when I think of Graham Greene, I don't think of a man wearing a certain kind of clothes, keeping me at bay with his courtesy, offering me a drink in his apartment. I think of that voice that goes right into my soul. And I think of that person that I meet on the page with whom I feel I have a much more powerful and intimate interaction than I could ever have with life. So I'm glad that I didn't compromise or complicate or dilute the Graham Greene inside my head with a real person who couldn't begin to live up to what I project on Graham Greene.
And not to mention that whatever unanswered questions you have about Graham Greene, you can provide his answers now.
That's wonderful. Exactly, yes. And I suppose I've tried to do that in this book. But yes, it's probably become a monologue between me talking to myself and ascribing some of those sentiments to Graham Greene.
Pico Iyer, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a real delight, Jim. Thank you so much.